This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Maybe it's easier to be an activist with a degree blending into a big city. It's never been easy for Adam Hall. He is an example of why we do need a power shift in many ways. Adam, thank you for speaking out, and thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be here.
So where are you from, Adam?
I'm from a little town called Glendaniel, West Virginia. It's in the southern extraction communities in the central Appalachian Mountains. I live kind of at a hub where most of the surface miners go to and fro from work. There's no active mining directly where I live, but it does have a way of helping keep the businesses, keep the momentum going for mining down in the lower portion of our state.
And talk to us about the nature you knew when you were young and then how you drifted into city life.
When I was young, my parents were still together, so it was really easy for me to just kind of be in the woods. And even after they separated, we still had, you know, an abundant forest right around anywhere I could go. But as I started getting older, my mom started needing to find more work in closer work locations. We were forced to move into a larger city urban area. So I was forced out of the woods into, you know, the concrete jungle, I guess is the best way I can describe it. And it was roughly about 13 years before I was able to get back into the woods. And in that time, I forgot a lot about it. So I'm still catching up on a lot of my childhood, you know, I feel.
And then you did what many young people from Appalachia do. You joined the military. Is that right?
I did. When I was getting to the beginning of my junior year, I started realizing my academic career would be halted if I wasn't able to come up with the money. I didn't have a whole lot of access to like how to navigate through scholarships or any kind of work study programs or anything like that. So we did have recruiters who came in very frequently who mentioned that we could get the GI Bill for college education if we completed our service in the military. They don't seem to tell you all the hoops you have to jump through in order to get that money. I completed 4 out of a 6-year contract, and there was so much that after so many experiences across seas, I rebelled, resisted a lot while I was in. They did chapter me out eventually, and it was a tough decision to make, knowing that that would be a mark on my record. I'm not very proud to have that mark, but it was either get myself chaptered out or, you know, never being able to come to grips with what was, when I talk about the military, I get so many different emotions that come through. It's really hard.
It's not easy. And, you know, Adam, I think this is a powerful part of your story because I know at least a half dozen other vets who think their country could be better. Many served overseas. Now they're activists who are trying to fight peacefully and they still expect to win. Have you met other vets who are concerned about, for example, out of control climate change?
I've met one vet in particular, and she's been really, an inspiration to me. Her name's Maggie Martin. She works for Iraqi Vets Against the War. I always felt like she's a really powerful voice, and she's really highly motivated. I like to keep up with what her work and everything. Her work kind of motivates me to continue doing the grassroots work here in southern West Virginia.
Well, it sounds like your family has been wrapped up in Peabody coal, and how could it be otherwise where you lived? Does that make it hard to criticize King Coal?
First of all, I really just want to stress that Peabody Coal is a demon on earth. My stepfather worked for Peabody almost 30 years, and he never worked for Patriot Coal one day. But when Peabody sold their union obligations to Patriot in this building a company that was designed to fail, you know, it didn't just take my dad down. You know, it was on the verge of taking down, you know, whole communities in this area who worked very loyally for Peabody, and to have them turn their back on that kind of loyalty, I mean, there's nothing more than just absolute heartlessness there. This was all coming to a head when Patriot announced that they were filing for bankruptcy and that the union retirees' pensions and health care would be on the chopping block with that. At that same time, we were given this opportunity to go to St. Louis to help organize with Missourians Organizing for Reform and Empowerment, or MORE, and Black Mesa Indigenous Support in Flagstaff, Arizona. We all came together for an action camp last January, and I was given a good opportunity to go up on the steps of Peabody Coal's corporate headquarters, their global headquarters, and I addressed all of my grievances, all of my father's. And before I went, I asked every UMWA vet that I knew who worked for Peabody, who were involved with this, and I asked them what they felt and if it would be okay to try to help give them a voice. I knew that they couldn't get there, but could I in some way like yell whatever I could at Peabody to make them listen? And I got so many positive responses from that. And so for what little time I had a bullhorn in my hand, I wasn't yelling to that crowd for my own sake. It was for my father's and his friends and those people that he worked with and, you know, ultimately who were crushed, blown up, or, you know, are suffering from black lung disease right now. That was why I was there.
And it wasn't just the people who worked in the mines who got that pollution. It was the people who lived all around them. Coal is terribly polluting. Well, have you witnessed mountaintop removal mining, and what do you see?
I've been around quite a few active sites and a lot of sites that are going through what they call reclamation. I've seen how they set up the explosives and when they detonate the explosives. It's really, really, you can't understand what it looks like to see a mountain, you know, hundreds of feet in elevation and littered with vegetation and water and wildlife, just like in less than a decade, you know, be shattered, be reduced to rock, and that is it. And I've seen what the aftermath of those mining practices do. I've lived in a community where we had the worst flood that many of the elders in that community has ever seen. And these people have lived in that community for 60, 70, 80 years. And none of them could remember a time that they've seen whole bridges blown out, houses floating downstream from 12 inches of rain that came down. I've seen water come out of faucets that just, I mean, water is a clear, you know, it's clear. I've seen water come out milky white and brown and black, you know, things that they expect people to drink here and be okay with it. And then there's so many more things, like the air that people breathe. The things that you can't see are even scarier than the things that you can see. That's what makes, I feel, this whole fight so much more difficult, is when we bring that issue up that the air here is actually absolutely toxic, you know. Nobody will believe us. And it's hard to show them or get any kind of regulators in this area, any kind of morally obligated regulators in this area, to do the proper necessary testing to prove to legislators and lawmakers that indeed our people are dying just from breathing air.
It's like smoking a pack of cigarettes a day or something, you know, just to live there, and it shouldn't be right. Not for the kids, not for everybody. Who was Larry Gibson?
Larry Gibson was, in my opinion, the greatest man who's really ever walked out of a hollow in West Virginia. The stories that he would always tell me about growing up, he really lived a life that was harder than I could ever imagine, from being kicked out of his home when he was just a kid to getting work with GM Motors and being fired from GM Motors for suspected organizing, from being, you know, from coming back home and then like having company men come to his house and offer him money for his land that he loved, that he grew up on, that he had these like childhood memories. And where I feel like that was what he wanted to do when he went back to Cape Verde Mountains. He was wanting to relive out some of his childhood that he was forced out of when he moved to Ohio. When Larry would not sell his land, when he would not budge off of his mountain the companies who tried to do business with him, instead of leaving him in peace, they decided to blow up everything around him. Cayford Mountain, Stanley Ayres Park, is a 50-acre land trust that is surrounded on all sides by mountaintop removal activity. You can go to the top of Stanley Ayres Park, or you can go into the Stanley's family cemetery, and you can look everywhere around and see absolutely nothing. Cayford Mountain, where Stanley Ayres Park is, used to be one of the lower points of Cayford Mountain. Now it stands as the highest. Larry's air up there is extremely toxic. There is no water. The blasts from around the from the operation sunk all the water up there. And this was all, I feel like, in an attempt to make Larry surrender. And it did the absolute opposite. It really pissed him off. It fired him up to the point where he became a force to be reckoned with, in my opinion. And he traveled, a lot of times, money out of pocket. Anywhere and everywhere where anybody would listen to him or lend him an ear, he would tell them the story of what was happening to his people in West Virginia, in Central Appalachia, in these extraction communities where they're blowing up mountains. He would go everywhere, wherever, to tell these people this. And it was 30 years. He worked for nearly 30 years on this issue. And it really, if it was not for him, we would not have an anti-mountaintop removal movement today.
And so that almost sounds to me like a kind of corporate terrorism with the government being part of it. You know, if you won't sell your land, we'll blow up everything around it. It doesn't get any worse than that. So how did Larry inspire you?
It was purely accidental, actually. I was just learning about the resistance to mountaintop removal in Appalachia. It was in 2009, and I met Larry I saw him around at events, but I never got to talk to him. But at this one point, I met him in a West Virginia caucus of residents who lived in West Virginia. I met him in this caucus at Georgetown University for this mobilization called Appalachia Rising. We talked about our experiences and what brought us to this mobilization, and I gave a very brief why I was here, what I was hoping to get out of it. I always tried to figure out what went through his mind, but I've never been able to. But all I know is that me and him ended up talking separately after that group meeting up until about 6:30 the next morning about just our lives, about why we love where we live. And he simply asked me, I need help. Will you help me? Will you help us? And I've never been a person to ever tell Larry no. Since then, I agreed I would love to help him. He had this idea for a program where he would recruit other speakers for his foundation to kind of cover more ground in the world, to give more people an opportunity to understand what mountaintop removal coal mining was. And I took off with him many times. I learned a lot from him just by sitting passenger side with him as he talked, and we drove 2 hours to 16 hours. And I would always, every time he opened his mouth, I would be more and more motivated to get this fight over with. I really wanted to win this fight. I wanted to end mountaintop removal before he passed away. But sadly, it did not happen. So even today, I have this utmost loyalty to his memory and his honor and what he did for me by inspiring me not only to stay here in West Virginia and fight, but to do everything I possibly can to bring as many people, as many voices to the fight that we possibly can.
Well, Adam Hall, many of us listening to you right now are burning electricity made from the coal that came from this mountaintop removal mining. So do you have a website or a Facebook page or any place you'd like to recommend we can tune in and find out what's going on?
One of the best ways you can find where your energy comes from, if you go to iHeartMountains.org, they have a link there where you can actually trace where your energy comes from. You can also check out Keepers of the Mountain Foundation online. We still have our speakers program. If you're anybody listening once would love to have one of our speakers out to give a more in-depth explanation on what mountaintop removal is and how the resistance is fighting in Central Appalachia, I encourage you to fill out a form to have one of our speakers come out and talk to you. I would also recommend the rampscampaign.org. The Ramps Campaign is a nonviolent direct action group based in southern West Virginia, geared by community voices. They have done many amazing anti-mountaintop removal actions, including a tree sit that halted work on one permit for 31 days. They're very amazing people, and I would highly encourage anybody listening, if they would like to take a direct stand on mountaintop removal, to come and join them.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, listening with you to Adam Hall from Coal Country in Appalachia. He's not a lawyer, a scientist, or a writer. He's an American who cares about our climate and our world. Thank you so much, Adam. Adam Hall talked about iHeartMountains.org. He meant ILoveMountains.org. Find out more about Larry Gibson at www.mountainkeeper.org. RAMPS, Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival, is where you get your action on. That's rampscampaign.org. All those links are in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.